I want to describe two vaults. The first is in Wilmington, Delaware. Last year, a court-appointed receiver arrived there with federal marshals and a team of auditors and opened roughly 2,100 boxes. Each box had a customer's name on it. Each customer had been told the metal inside was individually allocated to them, their specific bars, their specific coins, held in their name. Many of those customers were retirees who had been persuaded to hold precious metals inside an IRA or a 401k. The boxes were empty. What they contained, in place of gold and silver, were slips of paper reading IOU. The second vault does not exist at all. On June 12th this year, SpaceX went public in the largest offering in the history of capital markets. On that same day, not the same month, an exchange-traded fund began trading that gives you a negative, 2x leveraged, short position on SpaceX stock. It obtains that exposure through total return swap contracts. It does not borrow a share. It does not sell a share. It does not, at any point, touch a share. One of those is the largest depository theft in American history, and the man responsible is serving 65 years in federal prison. The other is entirely legal, fully disclosed, and operating normally as we speak. They have the same structure. The paperwork is perfect, and the thing itself is somewhere else. This is the framework's reading. I'm Jason Keyes. Every other week, I score what this framework said on the record, work through what's actually happening, and give you dated specifics to hold me to. Last episode, I made a call about yesterday's inflation report and told you that if it came in soft, you'd hear it here first. It came in soft, so let's start there. I was wrong about the July inflation print. Here's exactly what I said 2 weeks ago, and I'm reading it back verbatim so there's no ambiguity about the terms. Quote, August 12th, July's Consumer Price Index. Brent crude settled above $100 a barrel last Thursday, first time in 2 months, up about 10% for that week after the Iran framework collapsed. June's soft print described a world that no longer exists. If July comes in soft anyway, my read on energy pass-through is wrong, and you'll hear it here first. July came in soft. Headline consumer prices rose 0.1% for the month. Core, excluding food and energy, rose 0.2%. Annual headline inflation came down to 3.4% from 3.5%. Core came down to 2.5%, the slowest annual pace since the post-pandemic surge. And the energy index, the specific thing I said would push this print higher, fell 1.5% on the month after falling 5.7% in June. Every single reading landed exactly on consensus. Not near it. On it. By the terms I set, that's a miss, and I'm recording it as a miss. Now, the reason I was wrong is more useful than the fact that I was wrong. And I want to be careful here, because there's a version of what I'm about to say that is just excuse-making. The oil move I was pointing at happened on July 23rd and 24th. That's the last week of the month. The Bureau of Labor Statistics collects price data throughout the month. So a spike arriving in the final week barely touches that month's index at all. It shows up in the following months, which means the test I named could not measure the thing I said it would measure. That's not a forecasting error. It's a design error. I picked a date that was structurally incapable of testing my claim, and I didn't notice because I was thinking about the direction of the number instead of the lag structure of the series. And here's the part where I have to be disciplined. The obvious move now is to say, well, the real test is the August print. August 12th came back soft. The call is scored as a loss, and moving the goalposts after the ball has landed is exactly how prediction scorecards become worthless. The lesson I'm taking, and stating out loud so you can hold me to it, when I name a test date, I need to check that the data series can actually register the thing I'm testing by that date. Now, one piece of context, which is context and not vindication. The energy pass-through I was describing did happen. It just happened earlier than the print I picked. Look at the annual numbers rather than the monthly ones. Energy prices are up 14.7% over 12 months. Gasoline is up 24.6%. Fuel oil is up 39%. Airline fares are up. The national average price of gasoline yesterday was $4.04 a gallon, against roughly $3.14 a year ago. The energy shock is in the data. It arrived in March, right after the attacks on Iran began. Energy jumped nearly 11% in that single month. I was looking for a second wave in July and pointed at a print that couldn't show it. Both things are true. The thesis is visible in the annual data, and my specific dated call was wrong. I'd rather say both than pick the flattering one. Second, the 30-year Treasury, and this one is holding. 2 weeks ago, I said the 30-year yield was the direct test of whether the late July move was a one-day reaction or a regime change, and I gave you a falsification condition. A 30-year that retreats back below 4.5% within a quarter is evidence against me. It's at 5.17%, not 4.5. 5.17. And BMO's rates desk described the move as long-term yields climbing back toward historical norms. The argument I published in July was that four decades of falling interest rates destroyed capital through an accounting asymmetry nobody records, and that the reversal since 2022 should begin repairing it. What I got wrong in that piece and corrected on this show 2 weeks ago was framing the reversal as driven by Federal Reserve policy. It isn't. The Fed held rates and the long end rose anyway. That call continues to hold, and it holds for the reason I revised toward rather than the reason I originally gave. Third, and this is the one that matters most, I need to correct advice I gave. Back to the vault in Wilmington, this framework has told people to hold physical precious metals, and specifically to hold them either in their own possession or in what's called allocated storage. A named custodian holding your specific serial numbered bars with legal title in your name. I published a scoring system for measuring how many institutions stand between a saver and their metal, and allocated storage scored well on it. That advice had a hole in it, and the hole is this. Allocated storage protects you completely against one thing, your custodian going bankrupt. The legal structure is called bailment, and it works. The metal sits outside the custodian's estate, creditors can't reach it. And when Lehman Brothers failed in 2008, the clients with allocated metal were untouched, while the clients holding unallocated claims became unsecured creditors. That protection is real, and I stand behind it. Allocated storage protects you against fraud, not at all, because the entire legal structure assumes the metal is in the vault. When it isn't, your perfect title is a claim against a man who has already spent the proceeds. Those 2,100 customers in Delaware had allocated storage. They had labeled boxes. They had statements. They had, in the technical sense, exactly what I recommended. And what they owned was a piece of paper. So the correction. My scoring system measured how many institutions stand between you and the metal. It never asked whether anyone independent had counted the metal. Those are different questions. And the second one has to come first, because if nobody has counted it, the first question is meaningless. The practical version. If you hold metal at a depository, ask who audits it, how often, and whether you get a list of serial numbers. Ask whether the custodian is examined by a financial regulator or licensed by an exchange. And ask whether the people storing your metal also trade or lease metal, because that was true at Delaware and at Northwest Territorial Mint and at Bullion Direct. And it is the single loudest warning sign in this entire industry. Now, the thing that actually happened this month, which got far less attention than it deserved. On August 7th, the American economy lost jobs, not gained fewer than expected. Lost. Non-farm payrolls fell by 23,000 in July. Economists surveyed by Dow Jones had expected a gain of 83,000. Some consensus figures ran as high as 95,000. So the miss was on the order of 100,000 jobs. And then the revisions. May and June were revised down by a combined 103,000. The 12-month average pace of job creation is now 34,000 a month. For context, an economy this size needs roughly that many just to stand still. Now here's the strange part, and it's the part I want to spend a minute on. The unemployment rate went down, 4.1% from 4.2%. How does an economy lose jobs and see unemployment fall? Because people left. Labor force participation is at 61.4%, the lowest in more than 5 years, down 0.7 points since January. The employment-to-population ratio is at 58.9%, the lowest since May of 2014. The unemployment rate improved because the denominator shrank. Bill Adams, the chief economist at Fifth Third, put it about as plainly as it can be put. Quote, "While the unemployment rate is falling, that is mostly for the wrong reason, not enough workers." Now, why this matters for something this framework said earlier in the year? In the spring, I published a series arguing that the mass unemployment story attached to artificial intelligence was substantially overstated, that the headline projections of 20, 30, 45% workforce displacement were far out of line with what the data actually showed, and that the narrative was serving institutional purposes distinct from its evidence. A reasonable person could look at a negative jobs print and say, "There's your displacement, you were wrong. So let me look at it honestly. Where did the jobs go? Local government education lost 50,000. Retail lost 19,000. Leisure and hospitality lost 40,000. Plausibly, the World Cup ending. Financial activities lost 14,000. Healthcare, the economy's main engine, added 22,000, which is below its own recent average. Those are not artificial intelligence displacement categories. That's a school district, a shop floor, and a hotel. And the mechanism Adams identifies, a labor force shrinking because immigration no longer offsets an aging workforce, is demographic, not technological. So the read I'd offer, and I'll hold it loosely because 1 month is 1 month, this is a labor market weakening through the supply side, not through the displacement side, which is a different problem with different remedies, and it is not the story that has been sold. The unemployment rate, at 4.1%, is still running below the Federal Reserve's own projection for this year. And one number that ties this back to everything else on this show. Wages grew 3.2% over the past year. Inflation ran 3.4%, which means the average American worker's real earnings, what the paycheck actually buys, went backwards. Average hourly earnings are down 0.2% from a year ago in real terms. Heather Long, the chief economist at Navy Federal, noted that inflation has now been wiping out wage gains for 4 consecutive months, and that for middle and lower income households. This is the whole ballgame. This framework has argued for 4 years that nominal figures conceal what is actually happening, and that only the real number tells you anything. Here is that argument as a single data point. Employment is described as near full, inflation is described as moderating, and the typical worker is nonetheless poorer than a year ago. 5 things, dated 1. September 4th, the August jobs report. Whether the July contraction was noise or a turn. Goldman's fixed income desk noted that for the third year running, July delivered a midsummer loss of momentum, which argues for caution before extrapolating. Watch participation as much as payrolls. 2. September 11th, the August CPI. This is the print that can actually register the late July oil move. And I want to be precise about what I'm claiming, having just been burned on exactly this. I am not rerunning my failed call on a later date. I'm saying the August print is where the energy question gets a clean test, and that a soft August number is meaningful evidence that the second wave never came. The number I'm watching remains the dissent count, 3 in July, all wanting a hike. And there's a live signal. Beth Hammack of the Cleveland Fed, one of those 3, wrote publicly on Tuesday that now is the time to act, and that waiting makes the problem more expensive. A sitting regional president campaigning in public between meetings is not nothing. If September brings 4 or more dissents, this becomes a chair with a control problem. 4. The 30-year still. 517 today, my published threshold is 4.5, with 1/4 as evidence against the thesis. That threshold stands, and I'm not moving it. 5. Mine to deliver. The data series I described last episode, computing the gap between the fair value and the carrying value of corporate debt from public filings. It's in progress. When it runs, this is where I walk through what it shows, including if it embarrasses the thesis. Last episode, I said this framework's value doesn't rest on being right often. Anyone can be right often by staying vague, but on making claims specific enough to be scored and then scoring them. This episode, I lost the inflation call and lost it on a test I designed badly. The 30-year call is holding. And I corrected advice I'd given about where to keep your middle, because 2,100 people in Delaware followed roughly that advice and opened their boxes to find paper. That last one isn't a forecast I got wrong. It's worse than that, and it's the reason I'd rather run this segment than skip it. Next episode in 2 weeks. I'm Jason Keyes. This has been The Framework's Reading.